Good evening. I apologize. I usually turn on the voice recorder during the last verse of the last song, and when I did that, it gave me an error reading. I guess I need to turn it on a little sooner than that. I had to figure that error reading out. My lesson this evening is going to be an exposition of Deuteronomy chapters 20 through 22. I'm going to go do this a little bit different in that we're going to just go through all three chapters right in the middle. It seems kind of strange, but as we go, I'll show you what I'm doing here. We're going to look at some things. It's really interesting. If you've ever read the book of Deuteronomy, you already know that it is a book of laws. As we come to this portion of the book of Deuteronomy, we're far enough into it to know that it is a recitation of the laws and regulations concerning the Israelite people and how they are to act as they enter into the promised land. A lot of people know a lot about the laws of God, meaning namely the Ten Commandments. A lot of people know about the Ten Commandments. They say, well, God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses. Moses came down and said, here's the Ten Commandments, and this is how you have to live for the rest of your lives. Many fail to realize that there were hundreds of commandments given to the Israelite people by God through Moses. Not just 10, but hundreds. Those 10 were significant. However, there were hundreds. As the casual reader from this century reads through these rules and laws, one may consider them to be somewhat strict, but it gives us a vivid glimpse into what God expected of his people. What does that have to do with us? When considering the laws concerning morals, it's not a far stretch to believe that God still feels the same way about his people. Why would he expect the people of that time to be morally upright and righteous and the people of our time in the Christian age to do whatever you want? We see that that's not the case. In fact, these are the laws that were very, very strict, and they were very precise. So God says, here are these laws. This is how you need to live. And then we have that. Now, the law of Moses was binding on the people of the Old Testament. We looked at that this morning in our class. But as we move into the New Testament, what does he say? Let's recite these all over again. Why not? He did it three or four times in the Old Testament. How many times have you read the laws over and over? It's like, oh, it's so redundant. We didn't have to. He says in the New Testament, we need to be righteous. How do we find out what's righteous? We go back to these laws and look at what God expected of his people. And that gives us an idea of what he wanted as far as righteousness and morals. Okay, so these three chapters of topic, as I mentioned, are going to be chapter 20, 21, and 22. These cover the laws concerning the following. Instructions for entering battle. You know, they're fixing to go into the promised land. Laws concerning how to treat an unsolved murder. I bet people didn't know about that one, right? Laws concerning women taken in captive in battle that they wish to marry. Laws concerning the rights of inheritance. Laws concerning the punishment of a stubborn and rebellious son. Laws concerning a criminal who has been hanged. Laws concerning lost and found and right and wrong. And finally, laws concerning sexual purity. While some of the commandments are a little obscure, and somewhat vague, others are more detailed. Time will not allow us to get into great detail on these, but as we go through, they're clearly understood. Some are clearly understood, while others are a bit strange since their culture was different than ours. So we look at that and we think, what in the world is that all about? Chapter 20, verse 1, for the most part, the Israelites were peaceful people. They couldn't, they weren't fighting people they've been in captivity for all this time, and even when they came out of captivity, they wandered around the wilderness among themselves. They took a lot of pride in who they were as far as family. The family ties were strong and deep, and they traced they knew what tribes they were from and all of that. So, however, they couldn't expect to take over another nation without opposition. So God lets them know that they are likely to have to go into battle in order to possess the land. It's interesting that no one protested and said, wait a minute, God, you told Abraham that this was a free gift. We shouldn't have to do anything to get it. We shouldn't have to fight. No, God tells them you're going to go in there. You're going to take the land. You're going to have to fight. These people are going to put up a resistance. They're going to resist, and so you're going to have to fight them. So then, anyway, God tells them not to fear the people of the land, no matter how formidable they may seem. These people had horses and chariots. If you had horses and chariots, you're the bomb. Everybody's afraid of you. I can remember how when we first went to Desert Storm, and those people, you'd see them on the news, and they're chanting, and they're going to kill Americans. They're ready. They're ready. They were ready to fight. And I saw a news clip, and it just was amazing that these guys come up in this little Datsun pickup, and there's one driving, and there's three of them in the back with their machine guns, and they come up over the hill, and as they look down, there's an Abrams tank sitting there. They turn around and go back the other way. They were expecting to fight people that were the same as they were. And they didn't. They come across an army, the United States military. They were way, way outmatched against the American military. So that's the way the Israelites were. They were outmatched, but God tells them, don't be afraid. You're going to be outmatched. They had the latest, greatest technology that the enemies did, but that's okay. You're going to beat them. You're going to do that. We saw that a little bit this morning, too, in our class. Verse 2 through 4, in giving instructions for battle, God knew that they would be up against, as I said, insurmountable odds. And he reassures them, however, that they are not to fear the inhabitants of the land, even though they seem battle ready. They're going to be going out, farmers and peasants walking up against soldiers. And so Moses tells them that God will make them victorious, just like he did their fathers as he led them out of Egypt. The people were to take the priest into battle. That's interesting. That's one of the things that they were supposed to do. Take the priest into battle. He is their man, their connection to God. And before they enter into the battle, the priest would check with God and see what's supposed to be. He says, okay, we're good. God says, we got this, go. Or God says, back off, we're going to wait until tomorrow. Whatever he said, this priest was their man, their connection to God, and he would be a representative of God himself. And so they would listen to whatever he had to say. Just before entering battle, the priest would give them a pep talk, so to speak, and encourage them that God was with them, and so they can go in confidence. Verse 5 through 9, in these verses, the captains of the armies give leave to those who have a valid excuse. That's interesting. Okay, so you think about this. We're getting ready to go into the promised land, and God gives them laws, and he says, this is what you have to do. Here's some things that you have to take care of. Okay, first of all, you need to get together the captains, and you need to find out those people there's going to be some people that are exempt. Do you know that in the United States, we have people that are exempt from the draft? How is that? How are they exempt from the draft? I remember when I was very, very young, when I was about 14 or 15, they were talking about the draft and all that, and you sign up for the draft, and they told me, well, you'll be exempt anyway. Why would I be exempt from the draft? Because I was the only son. I was the only one to carry on the family name. I don't think they care now. It doesn't matter. You can go or not go. I don't know. But there were exemptions. So this passage covers those exemptions, and the reasons are very generous. If a man just built a house, he could be exempt from going into battle. Why? So that he could devote the house to God. Interesting, right? Next, a man who had just planted a vineyard was exempt because his vineyard had not produced fruit yet. He had not been able to partake of his own fruit. If he got killed in battle, someone else would partake of that fruit. And that was, so God gave him an exemption. That's interesting too. A man who was engaged to be married was exempt. The honeymoons lasted a little longer then than they do now. Now, I get married on Saturday and I'll be back at work on Monday. Honeymoon's over, right? Or maybe go a week or whatever. Then they would often given leave from work for a year to spend time with their spouse, and whatever they did. Of course, in the industrial age, it's a little different for us, but that man was exempt. And then there was another exemption of those who were faint-hearted. You know what that means? Those people that are afraid, you'll have some wimps in there. They're not going to be able to go to fight. They're not going to want to fight, right? Those that are faint-hearted are afraid to go to battle. Why is that? The reason is those who were afraid to go to battle are going to bring the morale down of those who are warriors, those who are wanting to push forward. And so those were exempt. So once those who were exempt were weeded out, then Moses appoints officers to lead the troops into battle and officers over different groups. And that's pretty interesting too, or it's pretty simple. Verse 10 through 15, this section gives the inhabitants of the land who are outside of the Canaanite nation an opportunity to surrender. So in other words, you're going to go in there and you're going to wipe everybody out, kill everything, man, women, child, beast, everything, kill everybody. But there are some people you're going to come across. As you're going to get to the promised land, you're going to come across some people. You're ready for battle. You've got soldiers. They're going to battle. We're going into Canaan and we're going to take that land. But we come across some people out here. What do we do with them? Okay, they're not part of that land that we were told to destroy. What do we do with them? Okay, God says, give them the opportunity to surrender. Here's your choices. You surrender and become our slaves, our servants and surrender peacefully and become our servants, or we kill all the men and the women and children become our servants anyway. Interesting thought. I'm sure there were some people that resisted, and then when the battle hit, they were like, man, we shouldn't have done that. We should have took the offer. We should have took the peace offer, right? They didn't. If they did not surrender, if they refused to surrender, they were to besiege the city. Okay, so the Israelites were to besiege the city, and their men, again, would be killed. And we'll see that a little bit more as this moves on. The Israelites were to make their women and children servants and take the spoil of everything that they had. Everything that's yours is now ours. Verse 16 through 18, next instructions are given on how to overcome the cities that they would be taken over. Okay, so they give them instructions on how to take each city. Remember how they went around Jericho? Very specific as to how they were to take that city. It was interesting. They were to destroy, again, every living thing, man, woman, child, and everything that breathed, they said. And the people they were to destroy were called out by name. They're called out literally Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. God wanted these people destroyed because of several reasons, and you can get real, real deep because it goes back farther. But part of the reason that they were in the land was God allowed them to stay in that land so they could keep the land up until the promise could come. So in other words, y'all take care of that and keep it civilized. You know, keep the grass cut, keep everything down so it doesn't overgrow. Then when the Israelites come in, they can just take it over. Part of the reason he wanted them all wiped out is because if he didn't, they would become, a fatal attraction to the Israelites. The Israelites would start seeing the things they had, and we like that. That's really cool. How many times the Christians have fallen away from the church because they started hanging around with people that were not Christians and they were worldly, and they started seeing those worldly things and they started liking those worldly things, and next thing you know, they're no longer Christians. So God could see that these people would be a fatal attraction to them, so he should wipe them all out. Verse 19 through 20, earlier we read that those who refused the provisions of surrender were to have their cities besieged. And this was where they would lock themselves in their city. They would bar the gates. The cities had big high walls. Oftentimes the walls were not just a wall, but it was their building. In other words, I build a house and my front of my house or the back of my house is a wall. And you use my wall to build your house and the back of your house is a wall. And we go around the whole city that way. So the inhabitants lived on the walls of the city and they could literally get up on their house and see over the walls and see and fight from up there, whatever, shoot their slingshots or whatever they did, right? In a besiegement, they would lock down the city and they'd lock themselves in. They had storehouses. They found cities that had storehouses of grain silos as big as the ones that we see on these big feed stores and stuff today. These big silos, they had carved holes down in the rock where they had made silos and filled them with grain. Some of them, archaeologists have found still full of grain to this day. So they would build their cities and have these silos and they would storehouse food enough to live off of. Until the armies would give up and go away. The armies, however, would stay outside and they would live off of the crop that these people had just grown. So they're living off of the crop. So we can go through the whole harvest season. We can live off of this until y'all give up and run out of food. It was really a plot to see who could run out of food first, and then the other one would take over. But there's also some interesting things about this. In this passage, they're told that the rules of besiegement, one is what they weren't to destroy the trees that grow fruit. So they come in there, they're not to destroy the trees. They can't cut down a tree that's a fruit tree because they may need that. It may take them a while. So God didn't just say, okay, that city is yours. We're going to besiege it here. I'm going to knock down the wall for you. They besieged them. They had to wait them out. But then once they did, they followed through with the rules and they could use other trees to build their fires and stuff like that. We jump right from there to chapter 21 of Deuteronomy. We've already gone through one chapter. Chapter 21 begins with how to deal with an unsolved murder. I thought this was really interesting. A lot of people don't know about this. How many people watch crime shows about unsolved murders? Anybody in here watch that? I know that we watch them, and I like to watch them. I like the real ones, you know, where it's an actual play-by-play of what really happened, going through the history or the records of the police officers that are involved. They have unsolved mystery shows that are also just actors and stuff like that. But I like watching those sometimes. But here it says how to deal with an unsolved murder. That it's not telling you need to dust all the fingerprints. You need to clean all the, check out the, you know, they don't investigate the murder at all. In fact, it seems as though when they talk about how to deal with an unsolved murder, they're not even concerned with the murder at all. In fact, they don't go to see who killed them. All they have to do is prove that they did it. Does that make sense? Okay, so should they find the body of a murdered person and there's no indication as to who murdered him, they would take the matters to the elders. And the elders would then find, they would go and they would see what's the closest city to where the body was found. And they would go to the elders of that city and they say, right outside of your city limits there is a body that was found that was murdered. And y'all need to handle that. The elders of that city would then take on the responsibility of handling the murder investigation, which wasn't an investigation at all. Actually, it was just following through with the stipulations that God gave them. These elders would be responsible for making amends for the death of the murdered one by making sacrifice. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 22, and we've seen that passage before. Hebrews 9, 22 says, "And almost all things are by the law purged with blood, and without the shedding of blood is no remission." So they would make an offering or a sacrifice on behalf of the murdered person and on behalf of themselves, saying, "Hey, we didn't murder him," right? So they would make the sacrifice. They would take a heifer. It sounds kind of gruesome. They would take this heifer, and they had to take the heifer to an uncultivated lot where they would sever its head. And then right in front of the Levitical priest, they would bring the Levitical priest there, and they would behead the heifer there before those priests. And they were then to wash their hands over the beheaded heifer, signifying that we're washing. Remember when Pilate washed his hands? Washed his hands, why? Because he had seen that his fingernails were grubby and grimy? No, he was showing an act, significant act of, my hands are clean of this man's blood. Okay, so this is kind of significant. They would have this heifer that they would sever its head, they would offer it as a sacrifice. They would wash their hands over the heifer, signifying that they were clean of the blood or the innocent blood. They did not shed the innocent man's blood, nor did they witness who did. They were basically declaring their innocence of the murder. To have, verses 8 and 9, to have a cloud over you of shedding innocent blood was one that the Israelites did not want. You think about that. These people were pure. They were good people. They didn't want to have any kind of accusation among them. Not just like, I don't want to be accused of killing someone, but I don't want anybody in my tribe to be accused of that. I don't want, that's a black mark against us as a group. They didn't want that. And so the final measure of the stipulation is a plea to God for mercy to grant them forgiveness based on their innocence of the murder, which also explains why they need to follow through with these measures whenever a murder victim is found, because following these instructions would put away the guilt of innocence from their camp. So that would relieve all the people in the camp. We're not guilty of this murder. Okay, we're good. We don't have that black mark against us. Verses 10 through 14, apparently there were some in those nations that were allowed to be taken captive. I know it wasn't those direct ones, and it may have been those right outside the Canaanite land. But there were rules for that as well. If someone found a woman that they were attracted to and wanted to take her as a wife, they could do that. They were allowed to do that. However, they had to do certain things. First of all, they had to take her to their home and shave her head. They had to shave her head. They had to cut off her nails. They had to take her clothes from her and put a different set of clothes on her. Okay, so all of this was done. First of all, the shaving of the head, the paring of the nails, would be to humble her and to consecrate her to the new religion of her husband and purify her from her former heathenism. Her clothes would be taken, and she would be put in, given clothes that would reflect that she was in mourning for whatever loss. Most likely what happened is she was in mourning for the loss of her family who they just killed. So they go in and they kill the family. They could take her as a wife if they want to, but they have to go through this. She's going to mourn the loss of her family, but then she has to become the wife of this guy, right? It's kind of different, you know. We don't deal with things like that, but she was allowed to mourn the death of her parents a full month. During this time, she would be able to learn the cultures and stuff of her new husband and to bond with him. If after this he finds that she is unattractive, if he finds her unattractive at all, then he is not to sell her or make merchandise of her, but he is to release her back to her own freedom. Verses 15 through 17 as we move through. These two verses address the rights of the firstborn. Okay, so the right of the firstborn, we know what it is. The right of the firstborn gets a double portion of the inheritance, right? Okay, so in this particular culture, they were allowed to have more than one wife. If you think about this, it may be tempting for a husband who he has two wives and he favors one above the other one. Well, the one that he favors is not the one that gave birth to the first son, but the other one did. And so right after that, the one he loves the most has a son. He may be tempted to give the double inheritance to that second son, even though he was not the firstborn. And so this would prevent that. And so they were to give the birthright to the firstborn son regardless of which wife he came from or who they did not have the choice. They had to give the firstborn son no matter what. They had to give him the double portion. So that's kind of interesting. They couldn't bypass the other one. Now the stubborn and rebellious children, verses 18 through 21, the stubborn and rebellious children is kind of a misnomer. We see that and we think of who's a stubborn and rebellious. Anybody in here got stubborn and rebellious children? The moms and dads are going, yeah, I don't know. Some are going, yeah, absolutely. When we get into this, the farther we go through this, these verses tell the parents how to deal with such. Oftentimes the blame is on the parents for not requiring submission of their children, for letting them run amok, so to speak. But in this instance, it's a case where the offspring is simply rebellious and refuses the discipline that is brought to them. In other words, the parents are at the end of their ropes. We've done everything we can with them. He will not listen. We cannot get him to do what's right. The remedy is not to be carried out in haste. In other words, they're not to just say, okay, let's do this. Let's get this over with and take care of it. But the parents are to exhaust every resource they can to return this rebellious son to doing what's right. Now, when we think about this, as you look at this, we'll see that this rebellious son that they're talking about, the parents call him a drunkard. And he's a drunkard and a rebel rouser, whatever. He won't settle down, and we can't make him. We've tried and we tried and we tried. Okay, so he still won't comply. So if he refuses to comply, they're to take him before the men of the city, and they are to stone him to death. Oh my, who's going to do that for their kid? Hey, I told you four times, quit using them crayons on the wall. Now that's it, right? We say that because we're looking at it as we're looking at children, and it says rebellious children, but in reality, they're talking about adults here. Okay, so your family lives with you in this arrangement. The punishment may at first seem harsh. However, again, it's not dealing with a toddler, as we know from Deuteronomy 21 and verse 20. He was a glutton and a drunk. The reason the punishment was so drastic was to put away evil from Israel. And you think about this, it wasn't because of the gluttonous behavior or because of the drunkenness behavior that he was being put to death. It was because the refusal to change. And when you think about that, that's pretty interesting because this was a way of weeding out personality disorders. Okay, this we can't have people that refuse to straighten up and act right. We can't have people that, if they have a genetic personality trait that could be dangerous and murderous, you know, serial killers, they look at serial killers a lot when you see those, and we talked about unsolved mystery shows, a lot of the serial murders, we find that they have certain characteristic traits that perhaps triggered them to do the things that they did. Maybe not. But anyway, this was probably a way of weeding out a personality trait that couldn't be dealt with by reason, therefore prohibiting the furtherance of that genetic trait. Verses 22 and 23 deal with another aspect of capital punishment. It is interesting that the passage is given in such a way to allude to the fact that everyone hearing these words would already know that capital punishment is expected of people of that day. They didn't think of capital punishment. Like you say, well, you need to be stoned to death. Oh my, really? No, they said, yeah, absolutely. They didn't think anything of it because they knew criminals who committed sin worthy of death were to be put to death. If a criminal committed a sin worthy of death, he was to be put to death. And even the criminals knew that, and that's a good thing because even today, you think about this, how many people say, I'll go to prison, all my friends are there, I don't care, prison is nothing. I've done prison before, I've been there, like nothing. Because justice is not executed swiftly, crime runs amok. Okay, so these criminals were to be hanged, but they tell them if you have a criminal that commits a sin worthy of death, he is to be hanged. If he's hanged on the tree, then he's to be taken down. His body's to be buried. He's not to bring shame upon the camp or not to bring reproach or a curse upon the land. And so one can't help but be reminded of the curse being given or the curse of man being taken away, if you will, by Christ hanging on the cross, Galatians chapter 3 and verse 13. If you look back at this, there's a lot of references back to verses 22 and 23 of chapter 21 when you talk about Christ hanging on the tree or hanging on the cross. Galatians chapter 3 verse 13 says, Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree. All right, chapter 22. Verses 1 through 4 deals with what they are to do if they find a beast of burden that belongs to another or even to an enemy. Now, we don't do that, but I couldn't help but think of Larry one time went out to one of his fields and there was a truck there. Nobody was around. The truck was back in the very back of the field, just parked there. What's this truck doing here? Called the police. They eventually came. Somebody got the truck or whatever. Someone had stole it and dumped it there, or there was some kind of criminal element involved there. Well, here, we don't have these beasts of burden too much. There ain't too many people riding donkeys to church and stuff. But if you found someone's beast of burden, if you found something that belonged to someone else, then you were to take care of that, even if it was from your enemy. Even if it was their enemies, they were supposed to take care of it. They were supposed to take it in until the person that it belonged to spoke up. And if that person didn't speak up, then they were to become caretakers of that animal until they could find the rightful owner. Wow, what is that all about? The Israelites were expected to be righteous people no matter what their enemies were like. Isn't that a lot like Christianity today? How we're supposed to be in a sinful world, we're supposed to live in a certain way regardless of the fact that there's a sinful people all around us. So we have to be careful with that these rules didn't just apply to lost animals but to anything they found. Anything that belonged to someone else, the old mentality, finders, keepers, losers, weepers, that attitude was not tolerated by God then. It's not tolerated by God now. I know that when Larry found that truck in his field, he didn't say, wow, we've been needing another vehicle. Call his wife and say, guess what? I just got another truck. We can't afford another truck. Well, this one was free. Finders, keepers, losers, weepers. What would have happened if he would have got that truck started and run it and started driving it? Eventually, he would have been charged with a crime. Okay, so that kind of mentality still goes today, that this was started way back then. You find something, it's not yours, you don't take it. It's not just because, well, there's nobody owns it because it's mine. There's a lot of mentality even today that say, well, you're not breaking the law if you don't get caught. You know, as long as you don't get caught, you're not breaking the law. And I've heard even Christians say, no, I didn't break the law because I didn't get caught. Well, that's not what determines the law of what's right and what's wrong. They were also to help others get their animals out of a bind, according to these passages here. If someone had an animal that was buried or had fallen in a hole or something, they were to help them to get that out. Verse 5, while many ethics many of the laws of ethics of the Old Testament are no longer binding on us today, many have been carried on through the generations and even in the New Testament, mainly because they are wholesome and right. Unfortunately, verse 5 isn't one of those. It simply states that women shouldn't wear men's clothing and men shouldn't wear women's clothing. There are people that live by that today. In fact, it wasn't too long ago that women were shamed for wearing pants because that's men's clothing. Let me tell you something. The pants women wear are not men's clothing. I'm sorry. But there were some women that would not wear pants because they felt like that was men's clothing. And so they would not do that. But this is what this is talking about. To us, the clothing of the men and women of that era, they almost look alike, right? Guys, would you like to wear the clothes that the people over there wore? It looks to me like dresses. I don't want to wear a dress, right? Okay, so we look at that, but they looked at it and there was a distinct difference between men's clothing and women's clothing, and they could tell. So if a man was wearing women's clothing, whoa, 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 this ain't right. This won't cut it. And we can tell today even in our society. So I don't see anywhere in the New Testament where God's opinion on this has changed. Honestly, you can dig and look, but I haven't seen it. I don't see any laws saying that we can't do this, but I haven't seen anything that says God's mind changed on this. But okay, so verse 6 and 7 may seem strange to us. The people of this era would have certainly understood this. And this is because we have laws here concerning the taking of game animals. You have to follow the laws, right? If you're a hunter or if you hunt anything in the state of Texas, you probably already got your Texas hunting license for this year. Hunting license for this year, and it's already September. Well, the license goes from September to September, you starts in 1st of September and goes to the end of August, right? And most of you have already got that license if you've been dove hunting or if you've been planning on bow hunting or anything like that. So we have these laws regarding the animals. Why? I've had people tell me, a guy told me one time, he said, yeah, I was shooting these catfish in my tank with my bow. I said, you know that's a felony, right? It's against the law, right? No, it's not. My grandfather dug that tank. My grandfather paid for the water that went in that tank. My grandfather bought the fish and put them in that tank. And so therefore, I can take them however I want. I said, those fish still belong to the state of Texas according to Texas Parks and Wildlife. And if you take them by illegal means, regardless of whether you paid for all that, it's against the law. We argued back and forth. He still didn't believe me. But the truth is the game department does that. They monitor those things. Well, here, we're given some things on how the humane treatment of animals, mainly a bird in a nest. They would have gone and got eggs from a nest to eat those. We see a bird in a nest. What is the first thing you think of when somebody says a bird in a nest? First thing I think of is a mockingbird or a red bird or something like that, maybe even a sparrow in a nest. Have you ever thought about when it talks about a bird in a nest, talks about the chicken? I mean, they could have been talking about a chicken. A chicken is a bird in a nest just as much as a mockingbird is a bird in a nest. And so they were given specific commands that they were able to take the eggs from the nest, but they couldn't harm the mother hen. They had to let her go. So this would serve to prevent annihilation of species. All right. Verse 8 is a charge to make a battlement on the roof of the house. As I mentioned earlier, your houses were the walls of the city. People spent a lot of time up on their roof of their houses, adjusting their TV antennas and stuff like that, right? No, they spent a lot of time on the roof of their house because they didn't have television. They didn't have those things. So to get away, they would get up on the housetop. I know that there's something about a rebellious woman. It's better to be on the corner of the housetop than with a contentious woman. So I guess some of them husbands just went up there to get away from their wives. I don't know. But when you're on the top of the house, you have to have a battlement. Now, a battlement is not a handrail like the rail that we have on these stairs. There used to not be a rail on those stairs. I'm glad they put that there. And it's a good thing to have that. But that's not what the battlement was. The battlement would have been a wall that would have come just above the waist. Okay, and that wall would give you opportunity to address those who are attacking the city, the besiegers, to address them. But it would also prevent someone from falling off of your roof and you being guilty of their blood. Okay, so this was what this was given. They had to put this up, and it's just an interesting. So verse 9 through 11 have to do with purity issues when planting seeds, not to mingle various seeds. I've not yet figured out what that was all about. I looked into it. I studied it. I still couldn't come up with it. They were not to defile the fruit of the vineyard by mingling various seeds. The first thing I thought of is these, when we have places like Texas A&M where they make these hybrid plants and purple bluebonnets, right, for Texas A&M, or maroon bluebonnets for Texas A&M. A lot of places like that, they have mingled seeds. If you watch, all of those go back and they will revert back to the original eventually. But they were also not to unequally yoke. We've heard that, be not unequally yoked, yoke an ox and a donkey together. If you've ever seen the temperament of these two animals, you certainly don't want them tied together to try to do any work for you. It's not going to happen. The kind of struggle would take place that wouldn't be profitable. Third is the prohibition of wearing garments made from different materials. And I don't know if this was mainly just to show not to be like the other inhabitants of the land. Perhaps you wear all the same material. Verse 12 tells them to put a fringe around their garments. This is simply to remind them of the commandments of the Lord. I want you to put this border on your garments. This is what you need to do. You need to sew this around your garments to remind you of the commandments of God. When you study Old Testament history, you'll find that this later became a hindrance to those people because it became an object of pride for them. Matthew chapter 23 and verse 5 talks about that, and we've probably seen some of that before. Verses 13 through 19, seven verses relating to sexual morality, how a man is to treat a woman upon marrying her. These laws were to protect the women from a vengeful, hateful husband or an abusive husband. We often look at those people and say, well, the men are very abusive to the women, people of that culture. But it was to protect the women from that. And they were also, as were such, to gender purity in a woman before marriage. Okay, so if after marrying the man found that the woman had been dishonest about her purity, he had an occasion to appeal to her father, at which time if he was found to be wrong, if she was found to be pure, then he would have to pay the father, he would be chastised, but he would have to pay the father 100 shekels of silver, and she was to remain his wife throughout for the rest of his life. Verses 20 through 21 deal with the woman. Should the accusation be true, then she was to be taken from her father's house and stoned to death by the men of that city. This is, seems like it's really, really harsh, but they're putting away all kind of lasciviousness and fornication out of the camp. The Israelites are God's protected people. You're going to come into this land, and this is how you're going to act. You're going to be pure people. You have to be. You have to take the impurity out of your land. You cannot let the fornication and such to arise to such a state that it is like those other people of that nation. Look what they are. And so that's why you're wiping them out. So verse 22 in the event, we're coming close to an end, we're going to wrap it up. In the event of an adulterous relationship, both parties were to be put to death. This was to discourage such relationships. Remember the woman that was brought to Jesus in John chapter 8. And they brought her and said, hey, Moses said that she's supposed to be put to death. She's caught in adultery. She's supposed to be put to death. Jesus said, he that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. John chapter 8 and verse 7. Now, we look at this and say, why did Jesus go against the law of Moses when he said that? Because he was still living under the law of Moses. Well, part of this is because they didn't follow protocol. Both were to be brought together. If a man and a woman were caught up in adultery, they were both to be brought, and they weren't. They just brought the woman. If she was caught in the very act, they knew who the man was, but they just didn't bring him. They did not follow the law. And so therefore, the case was thrown out of court, so to speak. So verses 23 through 27, this passage deals with a different circumstance. That is, if a betrothed woman, someone who is engaged, is forced into a relationship, they are both to be taken outside the city and stoned. If she's forced into a relationship within the city, then they're to be taken out and stoned. And this is what this says is basically, if she is forced within the city and she cried out for help, then someone would have come and helped her. But if no one came and helped her, that means she did not cry out. And this is, again, is God's laws. But if it happened outside of the city or out in a field, then the man was to be put to death because she could have cried out all she wanted and no one would have heard her. And so the man was to be put to death. Again, bringing purity to or keeping the Israelite people pure by doing away with those people who would practice impurity, right? 28 and 29, like many of the verses we'd covered, deal with things of a culture that we find difficult to understand. Modern times, these stipulations seem foreign, but even a generation ago, people would understand it. This passage deals with a couple that is committing fornication and how it is to be handled. We would have a term, even a generation ago, we would have the term of a shotgun wedding. Even today, many people know what a shotgun wedding is. I can remember when I moved out, I grew up, I graduated high school and moved away. I use that grow up thing lightly, but I moved away and I lived in another town and I met a young guy. He was 18 and he had a wife that was 15 and they had a little baby. And I worked with this guy and I said, man, you're awful young to be married. He said, yeah, it was a shotgun wedding. And I said, oh, okay. And he goes, no, literally. He said, my father-in-law brought a shotgun to the wedding. And he said, like, yeah, he literally brought it. He said, he made sure I wasn't leaving and he wasn't going anywhere. So we call it a shotgun wedding in modern times. The man was to pay retribution. So in other words, this couple caught committing fornication. The man was to pay retribution to the father, the woman's father, of 50 shekels of silver. And they were to be married and to stay married the rest of their lives. Okay? And so that's interesting. But that's the way it was. Finally, verse 30, we see this command is as a no-brainer among moral people, and that it deals with a relationship between a man and his stepmother, his father's wife. We know from 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 1, as we just studied 1 Corinthians in this past semester of our Sunday morning Bible class, but we can see from 1 Corinthians chapter 5 that this thing was still going on. People still did it regardless of the command not to. So the book of Deuteronomy is full of laws and things like this. Some of them are extremely interesting. Some of them are dry and boring and repetitive. But for many people, the book of Deuteronomy is a waste of time. However, an in-depth study of this rich book will reveal God's moral compass and how far we've strayed from it. So we can make application in that we can see what type of moral compass God expects of his people. We can see what kind of morality God expects from his people. And sometimes we see people that grew up and they were taught strict morals growing up. And then when they grow, those kids grow up, they let their children do whatever. And you think, man, they were brought up in such a good home. I know they were brought up better than that. We see that all the time. I know they were brought up better than that. Why are they acting that way? Okay, so look at these laws sometime if you get a chance. Read through the book of Deuteronomy, and I picked those because that was my assignment for the lectureship that I'm going to be speaking at in November. So that is why, part of the reason why I picked that topic right in the middle of the book. But if you want, go through the book of Deuteronomy, look at those laws and think about how that would make our society better if we follow the laws that were given there. I'm not talking about we need to follow the law of Moses. I'm just talking about the general principles that are given in these laws and these restrictions and the morality that is there. If you have any need, if you haven't obeyed the gospel, or if there's anything that you need from the congregation, the message is yours. Won't you come all together? We stand and sing the song that's been selected.